Indie Media is DIY News. It is about people reporting their own news directly, without the need for reporters, bypassing the corporate media. There are now almost 100 Indie Media websites or IMCs worldwide, providing grassroots reports of struggles, campaigns, and protests. The project started 3 years ago, covering the massive Seattle protests that shut down the World Trade Organization summit. Uncensored and unsponsored, indie media sites can be updated literally anytime, anywhere, and by anyone. The open-to-all nature of these sites means that you can publish your own reports about your own issues and at the same time connect to a global network of grassroots news. What you are about to hear are some highlights from those global websites and the UK's very own indie media site. For more information or to get the news direct from the streets, check out www.indiemedia.org.uk.
Hi, and welcome to the show.
Hey, hello. Welcome back, hopefully.
It's Wednesday the 9th of July, and just want to give a big shout-out to the Sheffield Indie Media Radio, which aired for the first time on FM yesterday up in Sheffield.
Yoo-hoo!
Their show's running every Tuesday evening for the next few weeks, and it's part of the community radio station Sheffield Live, which until recently has only been broadcast on the net, but for the next month, Sheffield Live and Indie Media Sheffield Radio will be broadcasting locally in Sheffield on 106.6 FM.
Rock on!
Whereas this is 104.4 FM on Resonance. And coming up today, we've got a selection of highlights from the Indie Media Newswires, an interview, and lots of news from around the world.
And now we have a track called Detachable Penis.
This morning with a bad hangover, and my penis was missing again. This happens all the time, it's detachable. This comes in handy a lot of the time. I can leave it home when I think it's going to get me in trouble, or I can rent it out when I don't need it. But now and then I go to a party, get drunk, and the next morning I can't, for the life of me, remember what I did with it. First I looked around my apartment and I couldn't find it. So I called up the place where the party was. They hadn't seen it either. I asked them to check the medicine cabinet, because for some reason I leave it there sometimes, but not this time. So I told them if it pops up to let me know. I called a few people who were at the party, but they were no help either. I was starting to get desperate. I really don't like being without my penis for too long. It makes me feel like less of a man, and I really hate having to sit down every time I take a leak. After a few hours of searching the house and calling everyone I could think of, I was starting to get very depressed, so I went to the Kiev and ate breakfast. Then as I walked down 2nd Avenue towards St. Mark's Place, where all those people sell used books and other junk on the street, I saw my penis lying on a blanket next to a broken toaster oven. Some guy was selling it. I had to buy it off him. He wanted 22 bucks, but I talked him down to 17. I took it home, washed it off, and put it back on. I was happy again, complete. People sometimes tell me I should get it permanently attached, but I don't know. Even though sometimes it's a pain in the ass, I like having a detachable penis.
Detachable penis. You're listening to Indie Media Radio London on Resonance FM 104.4, bypassing the corporate media machine.
Okay, here we go. Here's some stories. Today, Transport Secretary Alistair Darling looks set to announce the go-ahead for 11 more bypasses and other road schemes, while paradoxically admitting that such schemes can only ever be temporary solutions. And so it seems that the much-heralded return to the days of large-scale tree process is finally approaching. The two anti-road protest camps have been set up recently, one in West Sussex and the other near the site that started the anti-road movements in the early 90s, before its time, Twyford Down. We'll never know, there might be one there in the 20s. When the new bypass at Twyford was completed, the old A road was turned into a meadow at some sort of compensation for losing so much land. It has now become home to more than 200 wildflower species. Butterflies, moths, shrews and hundreds of cowslips and probably lovely little bees making honey. But now there's a plan to turn a large part of it into a park and ride scheme. Hooray! And so protesters have once again taken up residence. Good on them. In West Sussex, things are hotting up at Tortington Common near Worthing, the site of a proposed bypass at the A27. It's part of the planned South Coast Superhighway, which is being built by stealth in segments, bypassing the existing bypass. This road would be an ecological disaster, crossing the important River Arun wetlands and then ploughing through a mile of precious woodland. Thousands, probably tens of thousands of trees would be lost, some including fine 100-foot oak trees used, and particularly a 100-foot beech tree thought to be the oldest in the forest. Camps are being set up, with one having around 20 people on site now, with treehouses and walkways. For more information, see Road Alert, roadalert.org.uk. And there's also a picture in today's paper, isn't there, of...
There is a picture in The Guardian of the camp in Sussex, yes.
Looking very colourful and fluffy.
Meanwhile, in Canada, riot police evicted hundreds of participants at Montreal's Tent City shortly after midnight on the 6th of July. The Tent City is in response to Montreal's housing crisis, increasing gentrification of formerly low-cost working-class areas and increasing homelessness. The Tent City activists have three demands: decent housing for all, the end of the criminalisation of poverty and homelessness, and the repossession of empty buildings for community use. They are stressing the anti-capitalist nature of their action, critiquing the root causes of the housing crisis in Montreal. At least 40 riot police were already placed inside the large park, and using floodlights in the dark, they proceeded to push back Tent City participants with shields and batons. Many people scrambled to gather their belongings, including their tents and tarps, while others maintained a line in front of the riot police, chanting defiant slogans in defence of the Tent City. At least 4 people were arrested inside the park. According to one legal team member, at least 12 people were arrested in total.
Once more, the US-based Adbusters Group is calling on folk of all inclinations to get their markers ready and go for it with a spot of subvertising. Mm. Those with more time on their hands, as some folk in Oxford seem to have, can take it further, launching a fully-fledged subvertising campaign. Adbusters themselves target corporations whose logos are all pervasive and whose ethics are dubious, altering the advertisements which clutter our streets. The Adbusters website has its own Dirty Dozen listed here in reverse order: Altria, Clear Channel, Starbucks, AOL Time Warner, Gap, Microsoft, Coca-Cola, Disney, Walmart, Nike, ExxonMobil, and of course, topping the vote list is McDonald's. For more information on this, check out the Indie Media website with the Oxford subsection. And just to add a little bit of information on one of those, Clear Channel, they're a massive media conglomerate in the States which seem to own most of the local radio stations in America. And Clear Channel have in fact been the target of a lot of media campaigns over in the States, and has recently been in the press with the UK's deregulation allowing outside companies to actually take advantage of the deregulation in the communications bill, allowing outside companies to take over local UK radio stations. And quite a lot of radio stations have been making noises saying they will resist any attempts by Clear Channel to bring their monopolistic practices over here to the UK. And Clear Channel have been accused of being staunchly pro-war in America over the Iraq crisis, and in fact actually organising their own pro-war rallies and reporting on them. We've in fact reported on this radio show a couple of months ago that in Bristol people were subvertising Clear Channel billboards, and I think there's probably going to be a lot more of this coming up over the next few months.
It actually seems that more and more over the past few months, especially around the war, that Clear Channel are becoming much more obvious on the streets now.
I was talking to some Canadian people, and they were telling me that they have a very Christian right-wing fundamentalist agenda. Mm-hmm. So they're definitely ones to watch.
And certainly capitalist agenda.
And next up we have a track.
La, la, la.
And the track is Pledge to Resist, which is a Cold Cut remix from the Peace Not War CD.
Another world is possible.
On the 4th of July, American Independence Day was marked this side of the pond with events at several US military bases across the country declaring independence from America. Campaigners from Oxford met with other local activists and marched to the United States Air Force Base at Fairford. Fairford became a focus of direct action and protest during the attacks on Iraq, with planes taking off on bombing missions on almost a daily basis. The demonstrators assembled in Fairford Village at 3 o'clock, with many in fancy dress, as the event formed part of the National Gatecrashers Ball. Some of the men came in black tie, with women in comedy ball gowns. The procession went to the main gates of the base, waving banners and enjoying some of the Arabic music which people had brought along. On arrival, the Declaration of Independence from America was read and duly signed. The protesters stayed and had a picnic of cucumber sandwiches and fairy cakes and eventually drifted off home. The protest passed off entirely peacefully, with only some irritable car drivers raising objections to the protest. The demonstrations also occurred in Plymouth and at other US bases, including Menwith Hill, the US listening station that spies on our communications. About 400 people travelled from all over the country, north, south, east and west, to the Gatecrashers Ball at Menwith. The weather was kind, blue skies and sunshine. People rose to the occasion and again came dressed in wonderful costumes, including beautiful, imaginative ball gowns and masks, including some men wearing ball gowns, top hats and tails, all joining together for a public reading of the Declaration of Independence from America. Mark Thomas introduced a range of excellent speakers, including people from the Green Party and the Greenham Common Board of Atomic Scientists, and including people from Chumbawamba who were also speaking. There was a planned walk around the base, but that had to be cut short primarily because of chaotic policing. Two police horses were put at the front of the walk, and they seemed pretty inexperienced horses, and the riders didn't seem much better, clearly not being in control of the horses, as they reared up, backed into protesters, and were generally not fit to be at any demonstration. It became a potentially extremely dangerous situation, and this was in fact the first time that police horses have been deployed at a demonstration at Menwith Hill. Despite the organisers trying to continually reason with Inspector Shelton, in charge of the North Yorkshire Police, that they should start the walk and that the police horses should be withdrawn, this was refused. Later, the two horses were replaced with four horses who were only marginally better trained. The purpose of the walk was for a guided tour around the base, with stops at various places where Lindis Percy, from the Campaign for the Accountability of American Bases, was going to speak and give information about the important role played by Menwith Hill in the world's biggest global spy network.
The atmosphere was becoming somewhat tense because of the chaotic policing. Because time was running short, a difficult decision was made to go back to the main entrance and start the programme of music and speeches. Several people walked a short distance inside the base until stopped by the Ministry of Defence Police agency officers. The policing was generally heavy and unreasonable. The public footpath was closed by a rove police who refused to say under what act they were doing this. There was a wonderful lineup of artists, musicians and poets, which was hosted by Mark Thomas, who also spoke in his unique way, a combination of humour and political satire, as we well know. There was dancing in the road and later drumming. The demonstration was brought to a close about 7:30 p.m. There were three arrests for a variety of alleged offences. CAAB, the Campaign for the Accountability for American Bases, were extremely disappointed and somewhat angry with the North Yorkshire Police, since agreements had been made as to how the demonstration should be policed. But on the day, the police unilaterally challenged all carefully negotiated agreements. A spokesperson said, "As far as the policing was concerned, it was frankly a disgrace and not what we have been used to over the years. Events and protests against military bases and arms companies are set to continue through the summer, with one of the largest expected to be in London in September against the arms fair Defence Systems Exhibition International, of which more we have later."
And in related news, meanwhile, it's this Friday, the 11th, there's a vigil and a demonstration about the use of cluster bombs, intending to tell the British government that people expect them to clear up their deadly litter of cluster bombs and to ask them to agree to never use these weapons again. There are now more than 10,000 unexploded cluster bomblets in Iraq. One cluster bomb drops around 200 bomblets over a wide area, many of which, according to official statistics, at least 5% do not explode on impact. These litter the streets, towns and fields in Iraq and detonate often easily when children scavenge for the valuable metal encasing the bomb. They were used in the 1991 Gulf War in Kosovo and in Afghanistan. The weapons are indiscriminate and cause horrific civilian casualties. Their use and the failure to clear up after them ensures that millions of people are left at risk. As I say, the demonstration is on Friday the 11th and people are meeting at 10 o'clock in Parliament Square to cover Whitehall and the surrounding area with paper cluster bombs and balloons at midday, followed by a demonstration outside Parliament. For more information on this, check out www.clearup.org or even Human Rights Watch at www.hrw.org. And coming up next, we're going to have another tune and then an interview about the Dicey protest coming up in September.
Radio London!
Hi, we're here now
with Emily Apple, who's come from CAT, which is Campaign Against the Arms Trade. And Emily's here to talk about the Disarm Dicey protest. Can you tell us a bit about that?
That's right. Dicey is Defence Systems and Equipment International, and it's Europe's largest arms fair, and it's taking place between the 9th to the 12th of September. And a week of protest and resistance has been organised from the 6th onwards.
What sort of things have been organised?
There should be a unity march in central London on Saturday the 6th, which is probably going to go from Embankment to Trafalgar Square, but that hasn't been confirmed yet. Then on the Sunday and Monday, we're going to have a counter-conference that will give everyone a chance to discuss various aspects of the arms trade, of globalisation, capitalism, all the issues that are intrinsically linked to the arms trade, and also give people a good chance to prepare for the actions themselves. Then on Tuesday the 9th, there's going to be a Facing the Arms Trade demonstration called by CAT, and that will be a combination of peaceful protests standing on the pavement and bearing witness to the arms dealers, and also sort of non-violent direct action will be happening around the site. And then the other event that's planned is on the 10th, and that's called by Destroy Dicey, who are calling for a day of direct action blockades to shut down the arms fair by any means necessary.
What do you mean by direct action blockades?
Direct action blockades are using bodies, barricades, whatever people can to stop delegates actually getting to the arms fair and therefore making it useless for them.
Where are all these delegates from? Who are these delegates?
In 2001, there were delegates from 79 different countries, and some of them are government officials, some of them are private dealers, brokering deals. They come from all over the place because the arms trade is made up of people who and businesses who are solely operating for profit, so it's a big thing.
You said 2001. What happened in 2001?
In 2001, the first day of the arms trade was actually on September the 11th, so there were big protests which kind of got somewhat lost amongst everything else. And there were two separate demonstrations in 2001. CAT called one that was really just about 500 people who were behind, who were in a pending area, and a different group called Disarm Dicey also called a protest, which was a kind of carnival festival against the arms trade, which I think about 2,000, 3,000 people attended and was very over-policed.
And what ways did people try and blockade the conference last time?
In lots of different ways. The actual main day of protest wasn't really called as a blockade last time, and I think that was one of the major problems. And one of the main aims last time was actually to get into the conference centre itself, whereas this time it's actually concentrating on stopping the delegates getting in. Later in the week, there were actions on the roads, actions on Docklands Light Railway to try and stop delegates getting there by stopping their means of transport.
And is there going to be anything else happening this time?
Well, we're hoping that people will do whatever they feel is necessary and appropriate to stop the arms trade, and encouraging people to get together in groups between now and September and organise actions.
It seems like a bit of a cheek almost to be holding Europe's biggest arms fair on the anniversary of September 11th. I mean, it was fate that 2 years ago meant that the arms fair and the protests were happening on the same day as the attacks in America on September the 11th. But I think holding it again on the anniversary of that just seems really rather sick to me.
Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, when on September the 12th in 2001, most conferences and businesses shut as a mark of respect. Dicey didn't. They carried on. And where all the share prices fell, BAE Systems, the world's largest arms company, their share prices rose, so they've done really well out of the whole thing. We were told when we carried on protesting last time that we were sick. We had police come up to us and saying, oh, we think you're really sick carrying on after what's been happening. And
they missed the point somewhat.
Just somewhat.
Yeah.
And there's also going to be an Indie Media Open Media Centre running in parallel alongside with the mobilisation against the arms fair. And if you check out the Indie Media UK website over the coming weeks, there'll be information there how you can participate and how you can get involved. And the conference, for example, which will be going on for 2 days, will probably be streamed over the radio, and there'll be video streaming and a whole range of coverage, and also giving the many different groups, you know, from groups like CAT to local residents' organisations that are mobilising against the arms fair in their community. We'll be giving them a platform to speak and to actually put across why they are opposed to having these kind of events directly in the heart of their community, or anywhere, in fact.
Yeah, I have to say something that I found really disturbing on September the 11th, and that when we went and did this protest there before, was the number of people who are basically involved in buying and selling murder throughout the world. And, you know, it's like these guys were given police protection to buy and sell the lives of other people. And it was deeply, deeply, deeply disturbing. As you say, when this happened on September the 11th and they didn't shut down. And actually the police became more and more aggressive as the week progressed towards the protesters who were there, adamantly standing up for the lives of people who were going to obviously be targeted as a result of September the 11th.
I just want to say, is there a website for DICEY that people can find out details from?
There is. The website is www.desei.org. And there's also going to be a public meeting on the 26th of July at Yulu. And if people want more details of that, to go to the website.
Great, that's wonderful, thank you.
OK, and now we're going to a track from, I can't say this, Einster Sensi Neu Borten. And it's a track called Head Cleaner.
You're listening to Indie Media Radio London on Resonance FM 104.4. Your radical radio.
And from Schnooze this week, the weekly alternative news sheet, you can find that on www.schnooze.org.uk. We have a little lineup from there. Last week was a busy one for the biotech industry. In Sacramento, California, a $3 million shindig, organized by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, was attended by government ministers from 112 countries with the aim to bring countries together to launch a major new front in the battle against global hunger and poverty. All very noble, except the solution is being provided by the big biotech corporations who want to solve world hunger by stuffing genetically mutated foods down all our throats and lining their own pockets. Nice. The conference was closed to the public and surrounded by robocops with helicopters and a tank. However, some killer tomatoes and a few thousand other protesters, including farmers, gathered to vent their disapproval that all was not well and cosy in the world of corporate gene fiddling. Walt Kessler, a dairy farmer, said, "The truth about GE crops and their impacts on family farmers is being buried in a slick multi-million dollar public relations campaign being waged by the biotechnology industry and promoted by the U.S. Department of Agriculture." While Dolores Huerta, co-founder of the United Farm Workers Union, told a rally, "This isn't about feeding people throughout the world. It's about Monsanto or other large corporations making profits from selling GE food. If they really wanted to feed us, they would feed us healthy food. In fact, a lot of food is thrown away in the US because it's considered surplus. Even the big man Bush himself has been trying to feed the world. Well, it makes a change from bombing it." He told 5,000 delegates at the Biotechnology Industry Organization conference in Washington that European opposition to GM food was impeding efforts to fight starvation in Africa and nothing to do with the fact that the US has a large surplus of GM crops it wants to offload. However, not everyone believes that GM food will help reduce African poverty. Amadou Kanote of Consumers International Office for Africa argued that it will plunge Africa into a greater food dependency, which is very true. In fact, the argument that GM will feed the world is the last throw of the dice for a desperate industry fed up with a stubborn resistance to its technology and falling sales. In many research studies, GM crops yields have been significantly lower than conventional ones. Worse still, research has revealed an alarming spread of GE corn genes in Mexico in fields many miles from where GM corn was planted. The drift of GE crop genes to fields planted with organic and conventional crops is something that is impossible to contain.
And in 1998, a delegation representing every African country except South Africa put a joint statement to a UN conference on genetic research. The delegates had been inspired by a Monsanto campaign that used images of starving African children to plug its technology. Very sly. The statement read, "We strongly object that the image of the poor and hungry from our countries is being used by giant multinational corporations to push a technology that is neither safe, environmentally friendly, nor beneficial to us. We do not believe that such companies or gene technologies will help our farmers to produce the food that is needed in the 21st century. On the contrary, we think it will destroy the diversity, the local knowledge and the sustainable agricultural systems that our farmers have developed for millennia and that it will undermine our capacity to feed ourselves." A report by Food First argues that there is already enough food in the world to feed the population 1.5 times over and that it is poverty and inequality that is leading to starvation. In fact, almost 80% of the countries that face hunger are food-exporting nations. One of the report's authors, Silvia Roberto, put it, "They benefit the richest people in the world, not the hungriest. GE crops are designed to take control of production of food away from local communities by creating greater dependence on huge agribusinesses, corporations for seed and pesticides. In the US, this has already happened with farmers under the control of a handful of multinational corporations, such as Monsanto, Syngenta, Bayer, and DuPont. Legally binding agreements force them to buy expensive new seeds from the biotech corporations each season, as well as the corporations' herbicides, and company inspectors check up on farmers' land to see if any crops have reseeded. They can then claim the farmers are growing unlicensed crop and infringing its intellectual property rights. Already, some farmers have been given huge fines, and their legal actions pending against 550 North American farmers. Another thing that was on the radio the other day, on the other Friday radio show, was that in Argentina, where they are planting so much food, genetically modified food, there has been massive, massive floods there, and the water has not seeped down, and it hasn't been able to absorb into the ground to actually clear, because apparently the Roundup, which is a Monsanto spray that people have to, like pesticide that people put on their food, is creating almost like a cement effect on the land, so the water is not actually able to drain into the land as it normally would given organic farming, and so you have massive floods. And then the genetically modified food that has been grown there has been fed to cattle in Europe and America. And finally, they've started giving some of this soya products to the children over there. And as a result, the children age 5 are now eating genetically modified soya. And children age 5 with breasts and having periods, that's both male and females with very large breasts and having periods, and 8, 9, 10-year-olds are pregnant.
And that's a reference to the estrogen that's found
in the soya, yeah.
I mean, with
genetically modified soya.
With the European Union this week, they're going to vote that all genetically modified foods must be traceable and clearly labelled, while America's pressing the WTO, that's the World Trade Organization, to rule that this is an unfair barrier to trade. So on the one hand, you've got the European Union saying that they want genetically modified foods to be traceable and labelled. On the other, you've got America pressing that this is going to be an unfair barrier to trade, the line that America seems to be taking an awful lot on trade issues at the moment. So it's going to be fireworks at the WTO's next big meeting in Cancun in Mexico, and that's coming up in September. Cancun is set to be one of the WTO's most important rulings and may indeed start a huge trade war with the US. It's also a big test to see who the WTO will side with, whether it's the elected officials and ordinary people or the US corporations. For more info on this, check out www.foodfirst.org and also the excellent Gene Watch website to find out about some of the questions and issues that exist around genetic crops and food. And that's at genewatch.org. Also, in related news, it may have been covered last week, but just to say quickly, early last Sunday morning, 60 protesters in this country ripped up Syngenta's trial of genetically modified wheat at its Gellert Hill Research Centre near Bracknell, just before it was due to pollinate and therefore spread its contamination to the surrounding countryside. And that's just the latest in a successful line of trashings of GM crops that have been going on throughout the country this year.
Yeah!
Living up.
Ireland. Okay, here we go. In Ireland, on Sunday the 6th, the Salt Hill Air Show came to town, beckoned in all its military grandeur, billed as an air show. It is, in fact, a military show, glamorising the machines of war and desensitising people to their awful capabilities, with a small military village set up, complete with tanks and various military paraphernalia, available for the public to drool over and their children to play in. To draw attention to the fact that the warplanes overhead actually kill people, and that the same types of aircraft, and in some cases the same pilots, have been involved in many of more of the recent atrocities around the globe, and that war should not be a form of entertainment. The Galway Alliance Against War, along with other activist groups, staged die-ins on the beach of Salt Hill as the planes flew over. Fair play. A protest was also staged in front of many military vehicles, some of which eventually withdrew. Rock on. In related news, Irish anti-war activist Mary Kelly escaped charges of criminal damage to a US naval aircraft that she had disarmed when it landed at Shannon Airport in Ireland during the attacks on Iraq. The jury found her guilty of the much less serious charge of trespass, but could not come to a 10-2 majority to convict her for damage to the aircraft. Five more activists, the Pit Stop Ploughshares, are still due in court on criminal damage charges in October, which is similar charges that Mary originally had. This includes Irish-Australian Kieran O'Reilly. In May, actor Martin Sheen, who plays the US president in the series West Wing, pardoned the activists charged with the €2.5 million worth of criminal damage to a US warplane in the lead-up to the recent Gulf War. And now,
this is a piece coming from the British Museum. Apparently last weekend, the British Museum came under fire as members of the London Rising Tide, a network campaigning on climate change issues, converged on a BP-sponsored exhibition at the museum in central London. Members of the group explained that the action was intended to raise awareness among those visiting the BP-sponsored exhibition of BP's global activities. Activists converged on a BP-sponsored exhibition about memory housed in the British Museum to unmask the global politics of the giant oil company BP. A member of the group reports on their action, and here's what they had to say. Earlier on, posing as one of the two BP sponsorship experts, making an unannounced visit to our exhibition, i.e. wearing a suit, bright red shirt and matching spoof-logoed sunglasses, I'd caused a little bit of confusion amongst punters and security guards as to whether I was really from BP or were the supposedly random camera-wielding or anti-BP argument-wielding protesters. A museum employee said that this was neither the time nor the place to make such an exhibition and to be spoiling other people's contemplative enjoyment. I disagreed. After all, taking action now could result in the eventual cancellation of the Baku-Sehan pipeline, which would be an incredible shot in the arm for us all, struggling for an environmental and social justice and struggling to see the end of oil. It's true to what they say, if not now, when? The police have been called and security guards tried to remove the now fully unfurled banner BP sponsors climate chaos, arguing that they now owned the space we were in and that we had no right to protest there. Determination won through, and we were granted a victory lap of the domed space. We continued our presence outside the museum for a couple of hours, handing out our leaflets about BP and Baku. Stickers have now livened up the dull stone facades of these thumping great Victorian buildings. On our arrival, the police immediately focused their attentions on a couple of us, including our cameraman, but left once it became apparent that they hadn't a hope of charging us.
Information on that action, check out the Rising Tide website, which is www.risingtide.org.uk. And we're just going to come towards the end of our programme now. We're running out of time. Just enough for a very quick news snippet, which you'll probably see in the news today anyway, and that's that the President of Colombia is invited today by Blair to visit the UK over the next 2 days for a Foreign Office-sponsored conference which aims to generate further aid for Colombia. This so-called aid will be used to further repress the Colombian people for the benefit of multinational investment, say campaigners. Whitehall is refusing to comment on what military components may make up this aid, but The Guardian today reveals that the UK is providing secret military aid in the war against the left-wing guerrillas, including SAS training for the drug police, military advice to the counter-guerrilla mountain units, and a big increase in military hardware and intelligence equipment. In response to this, a number of groups from anti-arms organisations and human rights campaigners have called a vigil later today between 4 and 7 outside Downing Street, and a picket from 2 p.m. and a rally tomorrow evening. So that's this evening and tomorrow afternoon and evening opposite Downing Street.
I have a feeling we're going to see BP delegates making their way over to Downing Street to meet up with the Colombians.
Who knows?
Okay.
And now,
just wait for some stories coming over on Baghdad. Right, this is a story from Joanna Baker, who is part of something called Pandora DU Research Project. Joanna Baker's an organiser for the Pandora Project and the newly formed Radiation Child Victims of War. She reports from Baghdad on the fragmentation of the country and the news rules of the occupation. She says, why is Baghdad suffering? Electricity, it is said, has been restored in other towns. Only Baghdad is being denied this basic life support. As the heat increases, so does the desperation and bitterness of the people. There is total incomprehension that America, the world's greatest superpower, cannot provide in 3 months even basic services that government under Saddam was able to restore within 1 month. People believe that with the fall of the regime, the life-numbering deprivation of previous years would be over. Instead, they have never had it so bad. As one taxi driver asked of us, what have Americans come here for? There is no electricity, no water, no petrol. The roads are blocked. There is no security anymore. Why have they come? Baghdad is a city in trauma. There is no law and order. No one is in charge. People are crying out for help with their personal tragedies, but there is nowhere to turn. An elderly banker told me yesterday that he had approached the Americans for compensation for the bombing of his house and car, the death of his son and his daughter-in-law's miscarriage. He showed us his meticulously presented evidence in the form of photographs. Despite this, in humbling generosity, he welcomed us to Iraq and invited us to his home. Their warmth and generosity of spirit is apparently indemonstrable. During the day, convoys of American tanks patrol the streets. They are very dangerous. They plan to win the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people. Now, even those Iraqis who initially welcomed them are saying that if things continue as they are, they will not hesitate to take up a gun and fight back. The nights are filled with gunfire. So as you can see, the situation, or as you can hear, the situation in Iraq is pretty awful. We may come back to this story next week, for we're running out of time. We're going to go to a track by Anna DiFranco.
Us people are just poems. We're 90% metaphor, with a leanness of meaning approaching hyperdistillation. And once upon a time, we were moonshine, rushing down the throat of a giraffe. Yes, rushing down the long hall, despite what the PA announcement says. Yes, rushing down the long hall, down the long stairs in a building so tall that it will always be there. Part of a pair. There on the bow of Noah's Ark, the most prestigious couple just kicking back, parked against a perfectly blue sky on a morning beatific in its Indian summer breeze. On the day that America fell to its knees, after strutting around for a century without saying thank you or please. And the shock was subsonic, and the smoke was deafening between the setup and the punchline, because we were all on time for work that day. We all boarded that plane for to fly, and then while the fires were raging, we all climbed up on the windowsill, and then we all held hands and jumped into the sky. And every burrow looked up when it heard the first blast, and then every dumb action movie was summarily surpassed, and the exodus uptown by foot and motor car looked more like war than anything I've seen so far. So far. So far. So far. So fierce and ingenious, a poetic specter so far gone that every jackass newscaster was struck dumb and stumbling over oh my God, and this is unbelievable, and on and on. And I'll tell you what, while we're at it, you can keep the Pentagon, you can keep the propaganda, you can keep each and every TV that's been trying to convince me to participate in some prep school punk's plan to perpetuate retribution. Perpetuate retribution. Even as the blue toxic smoke of our lesson in retribution is still hanging in the air, and there's ash on our shoes, and there's ash in our hair, and there's a fine silt on every mantle from Hell's Kitchen to Brooklyn, and the streets are full of stories, sudden twists and near misses, and soon every open bar is crammed to the rafters with tales of narrowly averted disasters, and the whiskey is flowing like never before, as all over the country, folks just shake their heads and pour. So here's a toast to all the folks that live in Palestine, Afghanistan, Iraq, El Salvador. Here's a toast to all the folks living on the Pine Ridge Reservation under the stone cold gaze of Mount Rushmore. Here's a toast to all those nurses.